Welcome to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel, and I'm joined by Eminence Bill Werner, Brent Palm, and Ashley Walker. We're going to delve into what's happening in the North Star State. If it matters in Minnesota, we've got it covered. This week, keeping first responders and their families safe. Minnesota's archery season is underway. Controlling tree disease. But first, the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health have received a $17.5 million grant to help create a national network for responding to public health outbreaks. Joining me today is U of M Associate Professor Eva Enns.
This funding is awarded from CDC to create a national network of sites that will be working on different aspects of developing modeling and analytic tools and data tools to better inform response to future infectious threats like a pandemic.
And is a lot of this kind of on the heels of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Absolutely, yeah. I think during COVID, we saw a real desire, real appetite for models and for data tools and for web tools that could be shared with the public as well as decision makers and health departments around the country, but that people really needed lots of different tools to inform different decisions and different aspects that we were looking at. And so this network is really responding to that need to set this up in advance and in a thoughtful way and using this network, lots of different ideas from different types of organizations and so on, to all kind of bring perspective to those questions and what tools would be really helpful and needed.
And so is it fair to say it'll be created, you know, because, you know, during the pandemic, we were going to a lot of different sites. Will this kind of be set up as kind of a one-stop spot, I guess?
That's a good question. There will be a coordinating center for all of the sites. That's not what our particular project will focus on. But presumably that will be something that will be discussed and thought about, kind of where should these tools be available and how do they get disseminated in a way that is, they're both useful and locatable for people who need to use them.
What will be the U of M's focus in this committee in organizing it?
Right. So we are one of the integration sites. So in addition to doing general modeling and analytic infrastructure, which all the sites will contribute to, we in particular will be focusing on pilot testing tools and methods with our implementation partners, who are the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Electronic Health Records Consortium, so that consortium of health systems in the state. And we'll actually be implementing and tailoring and trying out these tools in infectious disease response type decision making and seeing if we can, you know, improve upon them and design them in a way that they'll be ready to go when we need them in a crisis.
Well, those are all the questions I had. Was there anything else you wanted to add today?
No, just we're excited to be a part of this, and I think it's really a testament to the way that Minnesota used modeling and analytics during the COVID pandemic and the role that MDH played as well as the consortium and the University of Minnesota in doing all of the modeling work that we did in those early days. And so we are fortunate to be selected to continue that kind of work.
Thanks again to my guest, U of M Associate Professor Eva Enns. More Minnesota Matters after this.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed, could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. Every day, first responders in Minnesota, our nation, and worldwide put themselves in harm's way to keep citizens safe, and tragically, they don't always survive. MNN's Ashley Walker talked to Lanny Noble, president of the MN 100 Club, a volunteer-based organization that works to keep first responders safe and provide for their families if they die in the line of duty.
All right, Lanny. So tell me a little bit about the Minnesota 100 Club. What does it do? Who does it support?
So the Minnesota 100 Club was formed in 1972 when a police officer was shot and killed. Five men who were businessmen decided that somebody needed to help the widow, and they each pitched in $100 and took it to her, and that's essentially how the 100 Club was formed. Since then, we have given out hundreds of thousands of dollars, but most specifically, I wanted to point out that just in the past, like, 3 to 5 years, our organization has really changed how we operate, in that we've been marketing ourselves, raising awareness for what it is we do. And I think that's important because I got involved with this group in about 2010 as a volunteer and participant in different golf tournaments and fundraisers that they did. And at that time, we were kind of quietly operating and giving about $2,500 if a first responder was killed or disabled in the line of duty. And as of January 1st of this year, the club raised its death benefit to $50,000. Sadly, not long after that, we had a situation occur where we did give a widow and the gentleman's son a check for $50,000 when Josh Owen was killed in a traffic stop. Why I tell you that is from 1972 till about 2010, the organization had given out about $375,000. In 2023 alone, we're almost up to the $200,000 mark. So we've been able to raise more money, and as such, we're doing more for families affected by these kind of tragedies. So we do that through a few different things. We have a golf tournament, we have a fundraising dinner, and then we have memberships, and we have, you know, all of our board is volunteer run. We do have a part-time executive director who kind of keeps us organized and helps with our day-to-day operations on a part-time basis. But the rest of us, the group of 16, we're all volunteers. Coming up soon, we are working on doing a First Responder of the Year Award. And we do that by surveying heads of departments for both law enforcement, firefighters, EMS services, and this year we have added public safety telecommunicators to that. We surveyed them to get nominations, and then from there, on 9/11, we sent out over 60,000 emails to all of the first responder community for their vote of their peers. So at the end of October, we'll go out and award 4 different winners for their heroic activity throughout the last year. It's really neat this year that the Minnesota Vikings are also going to be partnering to recognize those individuals and allowing them an on-field game day experience. So they'll be giving them tickets, Vikings swag, and then bringing them down on the field for when the team warms up, which is really a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So that's a little bit about what we've been doing at the Minnesota 100, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that last September, we started selling the Minnesota 100 license plate, and I don't know if you've seen them on the roads at all. It's a black plate with our emblem on the left-hand side and a little red, white, and blue line that goes through it. And $40 of every plate sold goes to benefit the work that we do at the Minnesota 100. And they've, we've really been just selling them by word of mouth. We haven't started a marketing campaign yet. But we're working with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association to get information onto the desk of every auto dealer's finance office so that when you're buying your car, you can say, oh, you know what? I want to add on this Minnesota 100 plate to support our first responders.
And you were talking about a event that's coming up, and is that the Oktoberfest event?
Yeah. This year's Oktoberfest for first responders. I'm working with the St. Paul Fire Foundation. There are equipment needs in the St. Paul Fire Department that they've had a hard time funding, and specifically their firefighters and their paramedics need bulletproof vests along with other protective equipment. And so we are working with Tom Reeves, Hockey City Pub over off of West 7th Street, to do kind of a community celebration, to gather the community together. We're using, culture and art to create the buzz, to get families out and participate in this free event. Flint Hills Resources is our Family Fun Zone sponsor, and by that I mean that we will have two fabulous face painters that will be doing face painting for children for free. We'll have three big bouncy houses out there that's all for free. We have an artist bringing her mobile metal lab out to, in a controlled environment, teach children how to create metal casks. They'll be doing a little fire engine and a badge and an Oktoberfest themed art there. We'll have the Minnesota Wild have a booth. There are several other vendors coming out. St. Paul SWAT team will be there with their vehicle, and the St. Paul canine unit will be on site. The St. Paul Fire Department will also be have their paramedics out there and showing children how to teaching them about CPR with Rescue Annie. And then we also have live music, a beer garden sponsored by Summit Brewing, and all beers sold that day will go to benefit the St. Paul Fire Foundation. Tom Reeds has a old family recipe for booyah, so they're making the rich St. Paul traditional booyah, and the proceeds from the sale of that will also benefit the St. Paul Fire Foundation. And the Minnesota Fire Engine Club will be out. The Vulcans will be there. It's just going to be a great community-centered activity on Sunday afternoon from noon to 5.
That sounds wonderful. And when you say that the St. Paul Firefighter Foundation is in need of not only other support but bulletproof vests, that kind of comes up as, not many people think of bulletproof vests when they hear firefighters.
Absolutely. But it's no surprise to anybody that being a first responder has only gotten more dangerous in the past 3 years or so. And there is a need for our firefighters and especially our paramedics, who are many times first on these dangerous scenes, to be equipped with bulletproof vests. And it's just something that has not been allocated for St. Paul Fire, and so we've done a few different fundraisers to help the St. Paul Fire Foundation raise money for that specifically. They just had their golf tournament a few days ago and raised over $70,000 there. The other thing I should note is that legislature, Governor Walz supported changing legislation around reimbursement for bulletproof vests, such that it used to state that peace officers were able to get reimbursement up to $600 for these vests, and they just recently changed that to say first responders. So that is a huge step in the right direction for the state of Minnesota and for our first responder community. But with that, there's still a little ways to go to fully fund what those first responders need.
The MN 100 Club will host its Oktoberfest for first responders, a free family-friendly event this Sunday, September 24th. Time for a quick break. More Minnesota Matters coming up. Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. Minnesota's archery deer season is underway, and the DNR is hoping some hunters will submit samples for chronic wasting disease testing. MNN's Brent Palm talks with Wildlife Supervisor Eric Hildebrand about the importance of CWD samples and how they help researchers monitor the disease.
Eric Hildebrand with the DNR, Wildlife Health Supervisor. Let me ask you this, because sadly, chronic wasting disease has kind of become part of deer hunting seasons in Minnesota. With a broad brush, just real quick before we maybe talk about specifics, what do deer hunters have to do if they get a deer under these CWD rules?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, and in Minnesota, we have multiple areas that we're doing surveillance for CWD, chronic wasting disease, in deer through hunter harvested deer. In Minnesota, we only have a mandatory sample requirement for one weekend out of the year, which is the firearms A opening weekend, which is November 4th and 5th this year. And so those would be only in the deer permit areas that are identified as CWD management or surveillance zones in our state, and that mandatory requirement. So for archery hunters, we don't have any mandatory requirements for sample, providing a sample from your deer, but we do offer in the DNR here an opportunity to anybody statewide that has a deer that they want to get tested. They certainly can, and it's free of charge. So a hunter can go onto our DNR website and get signed up for what we call a hunter mail-in kit. And essentially, you just enter your credentials on the website, and we will mail you this free kit that has all the supplies in it, and it also has all the shipping materials prepaid and posted on it. So the hunter would be required to take out the sample from their deer, provide some data that's on a data sheet that's in that kit, and then seal it up and drop it off at the nearest shipping vendor, which we're using UPS this year. Then it goes directly to our office, and then we process it, and then we get it shipped off to the lab for the lab to do their diagnostic testing. That being said, you know, hunter might say, well, how do I find a lymph node? How do I get that out of the deer? So we have videos we created, and they're posted on our DNR website as well. Plus, in the mail-in kit, we have a printed protocol that has fabulous pictures that a hunter can go step by step and how to find these lymph nodes. And honestly, once you find one set, it's almost like riding a bike. That you'll see them in future years or other deer that you've harvested. They'll just kind of pop out at you and whatnot.
Is that the one thing you want? Lymph nodes? I mean, you don't want me sending any other parts of the body, right?
No, just the lymph node is what we need from the deer to get tested for CWD, and then data. If we don't have any corresponding data, such as the hunter's contact information, their DNR number, the age and sex of the deer, where the deer was harvested, so DPA, township range section. Again, we provide all the instructions for everything. We have quick and easy maps that are digitized, and you just click on the map and it populates the location. So we have everything very, very 1, 2, 3 step easy for the hunter to do.
I think people might like that it's not a mandate, but hey, you know what? If you're submitting this stuff, especially in certain zones, you could be providing some pretty important information for you folks, right?
It is, absolutely. Yep, this is very, very important information. It's one way to monitor the health of the deer herd. And even, like I said, we have certain areas that we have designated as CWD management or surveillance zones. We're in those specific areas of the state for a mandatory approach over opening weekend of firearms because we have known risk. We have identified CWD either in a captive situation or within other wild deer in that area. So we need to get a handle and get an adequate number of samples in those areas. But that being said, you know, there's opportunity that we want to give to those hunters elsewhere in the state that if they want to get their deer tested, we don't want to limit them by any means, and we want to give them that opportunity. So that mail-in kit is really a go-to opportunity. I'm also going to mention the partner sampling program. That's another opportunity that anybody in the state can utilize one of those folks that are partnering with DNR. On the DNR website is a list of those, such as some taxidermists that are out there. And especially with anyone that harvests a trophy, potentially a big buck or a trophy animal that they want to get mounted, you know, we don't want them to ruin the cape of their deer, because to get the lymph nodes out of the neck, you'd have to cut through the hide. And we don't want to ruin anyone's mount to get that sample out. So these partners are trained. They have all the supplies. I encourage a hunter to contact one of these partners in their area, ahead of their hunt, to make a plan so they know what they're getting into. Because when you do harvest that trophy, it's a lot of smiling going on and a lot of moving parts real quick. So making sure you have that plan in place of if you want to get your deer tested, you know what and who to call in your area.
You know, I've heard of, during firearms especially, you guys would actually have like stations out there, like spots, you know, besides the partners too.
You know, when you harvest a deer, you got to take care of it quickly, because it has that potential to start to rot. And so having a plan in place and making sure your time is of the essence to get it taken care of when it's warmer temperatures like it's going to be, pretty important. And back to that plan, what some archery hunters, if they are hunting in a deer perimeter area that has carcass movement restrictions, archery hunters will have to follow those. Even though if they don't get their deer sampled or don't want it sampled, the carcass movement restrictions are in effect for all harvested deer for those deer perimeter areas. And it's for any age deer, so fawns, yearlings, or adults. So make sure to be aware of that. And again, more information on the carcass movement restrictions are on our website or in the hunting and trapping regulations handbook.
MNN's Brent Palm visiting with the DNR's Eric Hildebrand. More Minnesota Matters after this.
You, my friend, have connections in the government. Yes, you. USA.gov, the official source for government information on thousands of topics. And like any good connection, there's no telling where it can take you. Why, one day you're getting student loan information. Next thing you know, you need job hunting tips. Today's road construction info could have you searching for telecommuting ideas tomorrow. The more you use USA.gov, the more uses you'll find for it. Passport applications, for example. They've been known to lead to a sudden interest in travel advisories. Our new mobile apps will even update you on the go. So whether you have information to get or ideas to give your government, check out USA.gov. Who knows? Lottery results today could lead to retirement planning tomorrow. USA.gov. With the right connections, there's no telling where you can go.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. We've heard a lot lately about the spread of emerald ash borer in Minnesota, but before that, it was Dutch elm disease. And in many sections of the state's large forested areas, one of the most dreaded diseases for homeowners and forecasters for decades has been and continues to be oak wilt, worsened in many areas by drought that's continued over at least a couple of years. Researchers are looking for new ways of controlling oak wilt, and one experiment involves climbing to the top of healthy oak trees and actually infecting them with the disease. MNN's Bill Werner talked about it with James Jacobs, Forest Health Group leader with the St. Paul Field Office of the USDA Forest Service.
I am working with an operational study with a group of collaborators in the Minnesota DNR, the Wisconsin DNR, and the Michigan DNR to really work with a technique that was developed at Menominee Tribal Enterprises on the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin to treat single trees. And single trees, by that I mean trees that were infected overland. So the typical infection pattern for oak wilt, where you get a spring storm or a summer storm and a branch breaks out and the trees get oak wilt that way.
They come in through beetles, right? The actual spores of oak wilt are carried on beetles, and they kind of burrow in there or whatever and infect it. Is that how it is spread?
Yes, sir. So it's beetles in the family Nidoduladae, often called picnic beetles, sap beetles. And so they inadvertently pick up these spores from spore pads that are on previously infected trees and carry them to broken branches. So they're attracted to the kind of scent that comes from those broken branches.
And then you've got something that's in a tree, and from there if it infects that tree and kills that tree, then potentially it can spread through the root system to all other adjacent trees that are reasonably close. Is that kind of what the fear is?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's what this treatment that we're kind of doing an operational study on is designed to alleviate. So mm-hmm. It's designed to stop that disease before it gets underground.
Okay, so keep it in the crown of the trees and keep it from going down the trunk and into the roots and then over to adjacent trees.
Right, and so it's to keep it from moving to those adjacent trees with a low-cost, efficient way of keeping it there.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the real expensive treatment for oak wilt happens treating that underground spread, vibratory plowing, and a couple of other ways of treating the disease once it gets underground, using backhoes to create trenches or pop root balls, things like that.
And you can inoculate against oak wilt, right? But that's a prior prophylactic process, right? Where you're trying to inoculate the tree against oak wilt, and you could go ahead and do that through a whole forest, right? But I mean, if you've got hundreds of trees or dozens of trees, that's going to cost many thousands of dollars.
Right, exactly. So you can treat with fungicide, and it's an injection system.
Mm-hmm.
Various companies will do that for you. But as you mentioned, that's expensive on an individual tree basis. And if you have a lot of trees, that gets really costly. And the problem with fungicide treatments is that it's not a real long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't recommend it very often within the Forest Service on recreational properties or for things like that. However, it does have utility for protecting real specimen, large oaks in your yard, things like that.
Sure, it's understand.
You have to keep up on. If people are familiar with Dutch elm disease treatments or emerald ash borer treatments, it's akin to that. It's something you really have to keep doing.
Sure. If you've got a specimen tree in your yard, right, or one or two of them, it's maybe a good way to go. But if you've got a bigger forest, either a personal private forest or a commercial forest, is not a viable way to do it, it sounds like.
Right. Exactly. That's not practical.
Now describe the process. If you have oak wilt that a branch broke off, right, and the beetles came in and infected the crown of the tree, you're trying to get it to trying to prevent it from going down the trunk and then into the ground and the roots and spreading to adjacent trees. So how do you cut off that spread? What in your research study, how are you doing that?
So what we're using, again, the technique developed at Menominee Tribal Enterprises, mm-hmm. by ancient foresters. And what we're doing is girdling.
Okay.
A couple of cuts, yeah, around the lower stem of the tree. And in their case, they used herbicide. We're testing whether or not herbicide is necessary, or if you can just do the girdle to interrupt the sap flow up and down in the tree.
So in other words, cut the bark basically in a little ways around the entire trunk at some point or near the bottom of it or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
So you're testing to see whether you can interrupt the flow down the trunk of this disease to keep it from going into the roots and spreading to adjacent trees. But then my question is, you're also not looking for a tree that's already infected with oak wilt because you kind of don't have control of that situation, right? You're actually climbing the trees and infecting them with oak wilt. Is that correct?
Yeah, Bill, you hit it right on the head. One of the more exciting parts of this project, we tried using natural infection processes or finding trees that were already infected to be included in the study, but it's really difficult to control knowing when those trees became infected,
yep,
or how they became infected, or keeping that infection at a reasonable height above ground. For example, was the tree infected 6 feet above the ground, or was it infected 40 feet above the ground?
That is James Jacobs with the USDA Forest Service talking about, I guess, what you could call cutting-edge research on ways to control the scourge of oak wilt in large forests in Minnesota and throughout the upper Midwest. And Tasha, although Jacobs says it's really a subject for another research study, he hopes that by reducing oak wilt infestations in large forests, there will be less of that stuff literally floating around on the backs of picnic beetles to get into the dear old trees that many of us have in our yards and up in our cabins.
MNN's Bill Werner with James Jacobs, a Forest Health Group leader with the St. Paul Field Office of the USDA Forest Service. that's going to do it for this week's edition of Minnesota Matters. Be sure to join us again next week on this MNN affiliate station. Same time, same place. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Tasha Radel.